here that I tout all the time, the need in New York State for $36.2 billion in infrastructure funding. Several of us were down at NACO, and we met with, among other things, people from EPA. And, you know, we're funding nationally $9 billion a year when the national need is over, well over $300 billion. In infrastructure funding, and that doesn't include septics and all kinds of other things that we need to deal with. So I just point that out for your attention, part of our body of knowledge. Today we're talking about Marcellus Shale gas drilling. It should be noted for the record that our counsel, Chris Crane, did reach out to industry representatives so we could get a balanced presentation here. We have not heard back from anyone. That doesn't mean we will not have them back on another occasion, but we do try to let everybody have their say here, and we will certainly open it up to the public for comments later on. So right now, you know, as we frame challenging issues that confront our state and confront our nation in terms of energy independence, energy security, but certainly those of us who live in the watershed, as many of us represent watershed districts, we also have an obligation to very seriously look at protecting the watershed and the inherent costs to the taxpayers that go with that. So again, I don't expect that we'll take any action today. We're beginning a conversation and a discussion today. So up first are colleagues from Riverkeeper, Craig Thomas and Jake Simpson. If you'd like to come to the table. Since the microphone is on, just please identify yourselves for the record, and we'll get going.
All right. Thanks. Thank you so much for having us. My name actually is Craig Michaels. I know people get confused with the two first names.
Oh, I'm sorry. Apologies.
No problem.
And my name is James Simpson.
James what?
Okay. Thank you.
And you know, what our intention today is just to provide you all with just a brief snapshot of where this issue is now. I'm sure most of you are familiar with it. It's been in the press. And really to, like you said, begin the discussion on this in the hopes that, you know, at some point down the line, perhaps the full Board of Legislators would consider passing a resolution and or expressing their concern to the governor and to DEC. So just to give you an overview of the some of the shale reserves in the U.S.
Can you do me a favor, just speak a little bit louder, because we have folks in the back of the room, and I know your voice is going that
okay.
way, but
sorry.
Thank you.
This is just an overview of some of the shale reserves that we have in the U.S., and a lot of our concern with the Marcellus Shale, which underlies the southern tier of New York, a lot of that concern, the concerns that we have are because of the stories that we've heard in other shale areas, such as the Barnett Shale in Texas, the Fayetteville Shale down in Arkansas, and of course the Marcellus extends up from West Virginia all the way through Pennsylvania, Ohio, and New York, as you can see on that map. Now, when we're talking about the Marcellus Shale in New York, this is the map that we're talking about. This is courtesy of DEC. This was in the Environmental Impact Statement. And you can see the green area in there is the west of Hudson portion of the New York City drinking water supply. And the blue area is the Catskill Park. And for those that aren't familiar, when we talk about the New York City drinking water supply, we're talking about the area of land that supplies over half the state's population, or 9 million people, with unfiltered drinking water. I believe it's about 85% of Westchester County residents get their water from this supply. And the entire watershed is under lain by the Marcellus Shale. But as you can see, the watershed's only a fraction of the actual Marcellus Shale in New York. And of course, this is the water supply system that I'm sure a map that many in this room have seen many times. This is when we're talking about the west of Hudson, we're talking about the Catskill-Delaware watershed up on the top left there. And these are the west of Hudson townships. Again, the watershed supply is actually now it's about 1.1, 1.2 billion gallons a day of unfiltered drinking water to half the state's population, and there's about 60 connections outside of New York City that tap into this supply. And this is a very significant picture that really, it's you can't talk about the watershed without, of course, talking about the Memorandum of Agreement, the MOA that was signed by not only New York City, New York State, but environmental groups and upstate counties, Westchester County. And this this established really the framework for which we are able to enjoy a filtration avoidance determination. So, you know, there's a lot of talk, and we talk about the gas issues, about economics. Well, the fact of the matter is New York City and other residents that enjoy the drinking water supply have a cost savings every day when they do not have to fund, through water rates, the construction of what would probably be a $10 to $15 billion filtration plant that would cost about $1 million a day to operate. So that is definitely an economic factor that needs to be taken into consideration. And of course, that agreement enabled areas like this, which is the Neversink River, to look like this in perpetuity. The idea is that instead of investing tens of billions of dollars in filtration, we can invest a fraction of that in watershed protection and buy lands around the reservoirs. And New York State has currently invested over $1.5 billion in protecting the land around the reservoirs. Now, this is a rendering of what an area like that might look like were it to be subject to industrial gas drilling. And I'm going to turn it over to James Simpson now to talk a little bit about the gas drilling process and what kind of issues are involved in it and why we're concerned about it.
Sure. These are two active horizontal hydraulic fracturing operations into the Marcellus Shale. The top picture is from West Virginia. The bottom one, I believe, is from Pennsylvania. Horizontal drilling is the next slide in the picture. The horizontal drilling is what we're talking about in terms of the Marcellus Shale. The Marcellus, which is the sort of dark orange band at the bottom of that image there, is deep. It's deep underground. It's about a mile deep. It's also very, very shallow. It's shale. It's like a brittle rock, and the gas is trapped within this rock. Recently, industry has found a way to extract gas from this rock. What they do is they drill down vertically, a mile deep, through bedrock, into this shale, and then turn at a right angle, and drill out horizontally quite a ways, up to a mile. Once they have that well in place, they inject under high pressure water, sand, and toxic chemicals. The water and sand literally fracture the shale. It breaks the shale. The sand and the chemicals are able to prop open those fissures, those fractures that then allows the gas to come up to the surface. Now, this process, it's a very sloppy process. This is far from garden variety gas drilling. Gas drilling in New York State is not new. People have drilled for gas in New York State for about 100 years. But it's been the typical drilling where you just drop almost a straw into a big pool of gas and let the gas out. It's very simple. It's very clean. This involves the transportation of a lot of water. Again, it's about 3 million gallons of water are used per frack to actually frack a well. 3 million gallons of water are imported via trucks and held on site, combined with sand and toxic chemicals to inject the stuff into the ground. Now, industry is fond of saying that, don't worry, these chemicals aren't that big of a deal. They're a very de minimis part of this process. It's true that the chemicals comprise about 1% of the material that's injected underground. But when you think that the material that's injected, it's about 3 to 4 million gallons of water. 1% of that is about 30 to 40,000 gallons of toxic chemicals that are injected underground. So it's a lot in volume. While it may be a very small percentage of the overall stuff that goes underground, it's a very significant volume of chemicals that are used. Now, these chemicals are stored on site. They're also trucked in. After the fracking process, a large percentage of the stuff that's injected down flows back up. About 40 to 50% of this flowback has to be recovered and processed, sent off-site to a wastewater treatment plant or some other suitable facility to process these chemicals. And it's not just the toxic the chemicals that are injected down, but it's also stuff that is naturally occurring on the ground that comes back up. These are called naturally occurring radioactive materials. It's a very well-known phenomenon that there's just these materials that are underground that are disturbed through this fracking process that are part of this waste. So the potential impacts that we have looked at are land disturbance. There's gas companies go out and they have to assemble a large area of land to drill on. They have to withdraw surface water from typically a river or a lake to use in the fracking process. There are these fracking fluids that are involved, and there are literally thousands of trucks that are necessary to each of these fracks. The truck traffic is significant. The thousands of trucks, semi-trucks, going across rural agrarian roads that are just not designed or equipped for this volume of truck traffic. What we've seen elsewhere is that accidents will happen. A truck will crash. DEP, the New York City DEP, is on record of documenting accidents all the time around the Shokan and the Cannonsville Reservoir. Just accidents happen. And God forbid one of these trucks would crash near a reservoir, allowing all their contents to spill directly into the reservoir. We're also concerned about the wastewater treatment, which I discussed briefly, and drinking water contamination. Drinking water contamination, we mean two basic pathways. One is from surface water. Surface water reservoirs like the New York City watershed, where you have all this surface activity, these big pools that we saw earlier, these ponds that are used to hold the fracking fluid and the wastewater on site. Our concern is that these things may wash into the reservoirs and streams during the flash floods and heavy storms, which the Catskills are somewhat infamous for. This is why this is a very active watershed, is because it rains a lot. It's a known area of rain. All this rainwater washes down and collects into the reservoirs. So at Riverkeeper, we're constantly on the watch for pathways, for surface water runoff that flows into these streams. That's one of our main goals, is to limit the amount of surface water impacts. The second area of drinking water contamination that we've seen in Pennsylvania largely has to do with the vertical wells that go down underground. These wells are encased in cement as well as steel, so they're supposed to be very, 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 very safe and contained. However, we've seen that there have been cracks. Some of these have indeed leaked. So what happens is, after the fracking process, gas seeps up and it can seep into underground aquifers. And indeed, there have been documented instances where state regulators have found that natural gas has seeped into private drinking wells. There are infamous YouTube videos of homeowners being able to light their drinking water on fire because of the amount of natural gas that's in their drinking water. There's an area in Pennsylvania, endemic, that has seen numerous well water contaminations. Now, fortunately, you know, people in Westchester don't have to worry so much about that directly. Yes, it's a problem. No one wants to actually see that. But here, we get our drinking water via surface water. So Riverkeeper really came out when we first learned about this and studied it and looked at all of the surface impacts. And so the summer of 2008 is when the story broke for us, when it really came up in our radar screen. We recognized that this sort of activity was simply inappropriate within the source of drinking water for New York City, as well as the residents of Westchester and other counties. So we've called for a ban on gas drilling within the New York City drinking water supply. We just think the risks outweigh any benefits that may accrue. As Craig explained earlier, the New York City watershed represents a small fraction of New York State's portion of the Marcellus Shale. The eligible land for gas drilling within the watershed is roughly 6% of New York State's portion of the Marcellus Shale. So it's really a small percentage that we're asking the state to wall off, to create this exclusion zone. It's our experience that accidents will happen, and it just makes sense. It makes sense on a variety of levels to exclude this activity from the watershed.
A couple quick questions. Thank you. Talking about watershed 6%, are you talking about any kind of a buffer around that, or are we, you know, like 1 foot outside, we could be drilling, you know, a mile outside? Is, you know, normally when we talk watersheds, we talk buffers. Are you recommending any kind of a buffer around the watershed where drilling could commence?
Well, you know, I mean, the thing about the New York, when we talk about just the New York City watershed, I mean, it really, it's all encompassing. I mean, if you were able to prohibit drilling in the New York City watershed, I think you would probably have a reasonable amount of area that would really already takes into consideration such buffers, just because of the topography. So, you know, if you had people drilling outside the watershed, they would literally be, you know, that any sort of contamination would go somewhere else.
So you're over the ridge line.
Exactly.
Or, okay.
Now, of course, this brings up a very big and contentious issue, which is, well, if it's not right for the New York City drinking water supply, where is this right for? And that's really a huge question, and I think that question remains unanswered. And right now at Riverkeeper, you know, we feel and we work closely with dozens of environmental groups around the state, including NRDC, Earth Justice, Catskill Mountain Keeper, the Sierra Club, who I know is here today. And I think we're all in agreement that based on what we've seen from the Department of Environmental Conservation, based on their draft analysis of this, this really should not happen anywhere in this state until there are proper regulations, until there are proper management practices in place. Now, you know, obviously it's hard to talk about this without talking about the bigger issues of energy problems and the need for natural gas as a bridge fuel. When we talk about high volume hydraulic fracturing, we're talking not so much about the actual gas, but about the processes involved in getting that gas, because that's really where the problem lies. The actual fracturing of the well, the stimulating of the production, may not be exactly our biggest problem. But when you talk about all the road building and the land clearing that has to go on, and the fact that there are no treatment plants in the state currently equipped to handle the wastewater, you start to get a picture of really, and you look at what's going on in Pennsylvania. I mean, Pennsylvania now looks like the Wild West, and there are enforcement actions and problems happening every day down there that we are trying our best to keep up with. And, you know, our advice to New York State has been to, you know, proceed with caution. In the face of risk and uncertainty, we have to err on the side of protecting public health and the environment. And do we think we can wall off the entire state from gas production? That's probably not likely. But to the extent that private landowners have leased their mineral rights, and to the extent that it's going to happen on their land, if there are regulations and management practices in place, then they will hopefully protect not only the public drinking water supplies, but also people's private drinking water supplies. Because you have a lot of cases in Pennsylvania where people signed over their rights, and there's money in the bank, but they kind of, a lot of them are regretting it, because now they've got, you know, now their drinking water looks like this. And their children get sick after baths, and their, you know, their livestock are losing hair and falling ill. And we've seen reports across the country, from dead cattle in Louisiana to there was a recent study put out last week about seismic activity in the Dallas-Fort Worth area that they believe it has to do with underground injection related to hydrofracking. There's places in Wyoming where the EPA has found enormously high levels of benzene in people's drinking water. Now, the industry, if they were here, I can tell you absolutely, they would say there is no link. You can't link hydrofracking to those problems. And, you know, unfortunately, until these investigations are complete, and until we actually have states that have the resources to monitor and inspect and investigate, I'm not sure if we'll ever get any definitive proof. But, you know, when you look at a place like Texas, Fort Worth, where there was no recorded seismic events in history, and then all of a sudden they had 11 in the span of, you know, a six-month period, you know, chances are there could be a connection there. And the same goes true for Pennsylvania. I mean, if someone's drinking water did not look like this before, but it looks like it after the gas companies moved in, you know, there's a correlation that we at least think warrants a closer look. And the problem with DEC is they really dropped the ball on this. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, I was up meeting with some people in DEC last week, and I told them, look, you know, from an environmental perspective, this was a slap in the face. The environmental community feels like we were just slapped in the face. I mean, if you read this environmental impact statement, and we have, we've read it front to back. We submitted comments that detailed over 240 specific deficiencies with this environmental impact statement. And this is just the big picture. They did not even consider establish any exclusionary zones. So not only the watershed, but the Upper Delaware River, the Wild and Scenic River, New York State Parks. Now, we know they can't go into the forever wildlands and the Adirondacks and the Catskills, but what about other public parks that are supposed to be, you know, held in the public trust? They didn't analyze cumulative impacts. I mean, it's one of the basic requirements of an environmental impact statement, as we are well aware. You have to look at not only what could the impact be on one site, but what would it be if you add all these sites together? If you're talking about 6,000 wells in the state of New York, what's that going to look like in aggregate? They simply said, well, you know, they had all these economic analysis. Oh, well, look, this is how many jobs it's going to bring in. This is what the economy is going to look like. But in terms of cumulative impacts, we don't really know what scale it's going to progress at, so we're not going to analyze that. That's just simply unacceptable. They did not include any economic costs. They talk all about the economic benefits. They didn't talk about the economic costs of, for instance, water filtration. And they really, really just did not consider any of the issues that we've been reading about from other states. And there's a lot of them. I mean, just there's an ongoing investigation down in this creek called Dunkard Creek, which runs along the Pennsylvania-West Virginia border. 43 miles of creek, officially dead. Traced, at least in part, to the illegal dumping of 8,000 gallons of fracking fluid. Those are the kinds of things that, and we're not saying that everyone in the industry is a bad actor, we're just saying that to the extent that those issues are happening, clearly there needs to be more regulation. And we didn't see any proposed regulations. A lot of people say, oh, these are the DEC's proposed regulations. There are no proposed regulations in there. They say everything is fine, we're going to do it on a permit-by-permit basis, and frankly, I think we all know that the state does not have the resources to open all this land up to another industry right now. And Jay mentioned the naturally occurring radioactive materials that are fine when they're in the ground where they're supposed to be, but when they come up, you know, show us a wastewater treatment plant that's going to treat them effectively. And just to wrap up, and we'd love to take some more questions. The public pressure is really rising right now. I mean, at the end of the public comment period, we had comments from.
Can I just interrupt?
Please.
Real quickly,
no,
before
please.
Forget the two things that you were talking about. The impact statement with the cumulative impacts, your response to that, and quantifying some of the negative impacts that are happening that you recounted. One of the reasons our last meeting went so late is we were arguing about doing our due diligence and quantifying impacts of things. Can you get us, we don't have to go into it now, but I just want to mention it before can you get to Chris, A, your response, Riverkeeper's response to DEC regarding the point by point, because that would be good for us to see.
Absolutely.
And any further information you have on things happening in other states.
Sure.
I know you have a couple slides and a photo, but I mean.
Yeah.
Absolutely. No, I can give you right now. I mean, this was Appendix 1 to our 150-page comment. This was case studies of just the different instances that we had seen reports on in other states, largely Pennsylvania. And they detail, you know, we had the most up-to-date information at the time. We're hoping to update this actually soon because there's developments that have happened in the past few months. But these are, you know, these are cases where states themselves, you know, Pennsylvania DEP has gone out and fined industries, has shut down operations, and is investigating the link between, again, the hydrofracking process and contamination. And again, you know, we're not alone on this. I mean, the comments that were submitted from environmental groups around the state, we work closely with NRDC and Earth Justice and Catskill Mountain Keeper to assemble a large team of experts, and we submitted technical comments that I believe, you know, 30 groups in the state signed on to. The EPA submitted comments saying that they had, you know, very serious concerns, not only about the New York City drinking water supply, but really having this in any watershed in the state. The New York City Department of Environmental Protection, now, you know Riverkeeper. Rarely are we on the same side as the New York City Department of Environmental Protection. They called for a ban on drilling in the watershed. Mayor Bloomberg himself has called for a ban on drilling in the watershed. The Watershed Inspector General submitted comments detailing some serious deficiencies in the environmental impact statement. The DEC's own employees union was very concerned. Now we know from people in the agency.
Both of them?
What's that?
The two who are left?
Yeah, exactly. We know from people in the agency that most people in the agency were not given a proper amount of time to look at this. This was something that was sent around on, say, a Thursday, and they were said this is going out on Monday. So they felt that this was serious enough that their union should write a letter to its own agency and express concerns. The National Park Service issued comments expressing its concern, and recently the Northern Westchester Watershed Coalition, among others, has written letters to the governor, and that's not to mention the showing of support that we've gotten in local papers, the Journal News, the Daily News, the New York Times, the Albany Times Union, all have written editorials calling for a ban in the New York City drinking water supply, as well as imposing some sort of safeguards for anywhere where this might happen. Again, we're not confident that this can happen anywhere safely right now. But we certainly know that areas like the watershed should be just taken off the table outright. And we need to look on developing best management practices so that if this is, New York has the opportunity here. Right, we're the only state that actually said, to DEC's credit, we're the only state that actually said, you know what, let's just take some look at this before we start issuing permits. So we're ahead of the game here. We have the opportunity to learn from the mistakes of others, and Riverkeeper and other environmental groups are hoping that we can work with legislators, work with industry to really come up, if there's a plan, where this is the kind of thing that can happen, where we can bring economic growth to an area and do it right and not sacrifice our water quality. Our ears are open to those sorts of plans, but we just haven't seen any yet. So, anything?
All right, so what we'll do, why don't we take questions, comments from the members first, then we'll open it up to the folks who are here, and then if there are any other groups here who would like to make specific formal comments, we'll do that. So we've gotten about an hour, so we've got time for a good discussion.
Okay.
Legislator, notice for the note for the record, Legislator Myers has joined us, and Legislator Kaplan.
Thank you, Chairman. I actually sat in on one particular session at NYSAC on this very subject. It was interesting because you had legislators from the directly affected area and legislators from around the entire state, and the DEC was there. I think it would be helpful if we could get somebody from DEC down to talk to us, which is where you were leading before anyway, because at least in that meeting, and I asked a direct question, it looks like they certainly were looking to bifurcating this New York City watershed versus non-New York City watershed in terms of some of the discussion, and maybe it's under pressure from groups like yourselves that they're looking to do that, but I think that's at least the impression that I was given. We were given at that session, so that would be important to hear, and also important to get their point of view. We don't have anybody here on the economic impact, and I'm not, this is actually an easy one for us as much as county legislators, because we don't directly receive the economic impact. Much of it is our jobs, construction activity within sister communities in southern and western New York. So we don't directly get impacted. We do hear the allegations of problems and good detail of how the watershed could be impacted. And for us to do a cost-benefit analysis, if it costs us $8 billion to build a sewage treatment plant and the economic impact is far less than that, then it's easy for us to resolve. But to do the right job, which you, Mr. Chairman, you always, and that we always all endeavor to do, I think would be helpful to at least hear the other side. Sure. And there is an economic argument that can be made, and it's a pretty compelling one. In terms of the benefit, if you look to the volume, where we use 1.1 trillion units of natural gas in New York State alone, and you're looking at 150 to 500 million, 500 trillion units of natural gas In any market, we would, you know, I think we were missing not understanding at least the benefit side. We have to certainly understand the cost side and all the impacts there. So I would just urge the committee, you know, to bring them in and to look to it. To the specific cost on the, so is it turbidity? Is it what is it that what's the number one problem in the watershed that affects us the most directly? Relative to, you know, potential activity that would occur. Is it activity outside of it, but trucks that would be going through the watershed area?
Yeah, I mean, there's a whole host. I mean, I would say that, you know, anything that has the potential to wind up in the surface water, so anything, any sort of erosion that would come from road building, truck traffic, spills, the wastewater ponds that would be, you know, that might be on site, any sort of... again, anything that could be carried with rains, you know, down into the water supply would be an issue. And of course, as we know, I mean, turbidity is probably the main concern right now. Absent this right. type of industry, that's just one of the main concerns that the EPA always brings up when they talk about filtration avoidance.
I think that's right. Turbidity from this activity is a main concern. Each of these well pads, we view as mini construction sites, mm-hmm. long-term construction sites. A lot of
well, 1 year. From right, I mean, they did say it takes about a year, and then the construction site goes away. Then you have an operational site. So it's not as if the right. I mean, that's at least again. I'm just trying to be objective in what I learned there. That they it does. It's very intense for a period of time, about a year. But once the site is built up at that point, it then becomes an operational site, and you don't have the action nearly as much. Were they correct in telling us that?
I believe that's approximately correct. But again, there's no saying that it's just going to be once. So there's the potential for tens, hundreds, thousands of...
Well, but the sites are multiple, right? Those are sites, the industry, again, Mr. Chairman, my questions might, or statements might, of course, I'm just trying to pass on what I learned there, that per site, because of the technology and the ability to go long distances, they're able to... site at the site,
multiple
wells with tremendous coverage distance as
right.
well. So
right.
so you, it cuts right. down theoretically on the number of sites that you would need because of the technology.
That's true. Yeah, there's, well, you have one well pad. From that well pad, you can drill down. I think up to 12 different wells going
okay.
off in different directions, like at a clock. And so you have a large area. Of land that the industry can tap into from that one well pad, mm-hmm. and so using these you know bigger pads is a way to limit the amount of surface activity, but that doesn't limit the amount of trucks that are necessary to haul in all of this water. And again, the number of trucks cannot be overstated. It really could be the number one impact from this activity is the road destruction and the, mm-hmm. all the debris that goes along with those trucks, which increases turbidity and other pathogens that may wind up into the reservoirs.
Mm-hmm. Legislator Testa.
Did I hear you mention 6,000 wells? Is that a projected number or something from New York?
Yeah, I'm trying to remember where. My recollection is that's just an estimate that's been thrown out there. Again, we don't really have a clear picture because DEC didn't really give us one.
Right, right.
But I know, you know, that is a figure that I've heard thrown out there. You know, again, that would be across the state. But that's something that I can get back to you on and give you.
That sounds like a large number. What was the average life of one of these wells? How long do they last? Is there any data on that?
I think it's sort of an open question. I mean,
the ones that have opened are still open. None have been closed.
To my knowledge, we don't have enough. Well, there's no experience in New York State with this type of
right.
activity, so we just need to look at Pennsylvania. And I'm not aware of any wells in Pennsylvania that have been tapped out, that have shut down their operations.
It'll be interesting to see how they leave.
I think part of the way that the process works is these wells have to be fracked a couple of times. So they go in, they drill down, they frack a certain area, they let
keep
that gas
out,
come out.
Out.
Right, and they keep on prodding with multiple fractures.
Legislator Agowski.
Thank you, Mr. Harkin. Speaking as the chairman of the Energy Committee, I have a different take on this. I obviously share a lot of these concerns, so let me run through this. As I understand it, this is a draft supplemental, the SGEIS, because there was GEIS done back in the early 90s on the summer drilling issue. So currently, the DEC proposal is to continue to issue permits, but they have agreed to do this draft. Well, this new updated supplemental GEIS. They've agreed to do that. They're doing that now. But the goal is not to use that GEIS to support regulations, drafting new regulations. That they don't appear. That's not the plan. Is to not to draft regulations. That's what they started with, right?
Right. Correct.
They're just updating the GEIS.
Exactly.
Take a look at mitigating measures, whatever. But
right.
So trying to understand the big picture here, they're doing the environmental review, but not with the goal of writing regulations. They issue permits, as you said, project by project. So that raises some questions, because I don't really understand how permits work. Seems to me, trying to understand, go on the environmental side, they have requirements to drill several thousands of feet below the groundwater level. Is that correct? I'm told they're supposed to go way, way down below the reservoirs, the whole watershed area. So if in a perfect world, and I'm not a scientist, but if in fact they follow the law and they're down 3,000 or 4,000 feet, down several thousand feet below the our drinking water, is it okay? I mean, can you explain from your scientific aspect? What are the possibilities? I mean, is that their answer? It's sort of a barrier. Well, if you go down, you do all the fracture you want down there, you're thousands of feet away. Is that a correct assessment, or are they guessing? I mean, is there a concern that 20 years from now, what they thought was you were down low enough could turn out that they're not low enough? Or I mean, can you just address that? Or is it not a problem? I mean, you've talked about surface water, and I mean, I want to get to that, but in terms of groundwater or the fracturing itself, I thought that fracture was going to
come back
lead into the drinking water, but I'm reading that they need to be many thousands of feet below that. So is that industry answer a good answer, or are there some concerns there?
Well, I think it's a reasonable one. I mean, yes.
It sounds
reasonable. I mean, this is all happening thousands of feet below the earth, right? I mean, to the extent that this was done perfectly, right, you could, perhaps it can be done without environmental damage. But, again, the industry really, tries to keep people's focus, particularly on that one aspect of it.
Well, I guess the question, how did the gas get into the drinking water in that glass if they're down so many times? Because you're saying the gas is leaking in.
Right, it's not just the natural gas, too. It's just methane that could be, that possibly is throughout the fracturing process starts migrating into people's drinking water wells. And again, I'll let Jay speak to some of the things, but these are all good questions. And one of our points is that, right now, we have more questions than answers. And so we're not,
Well, I'm trying to understand the problem so we get the answers. If you're down 10,000 feet, whatever you do, it's not a problem, then it's not a problem. But to the extent it might be a problem, then you have to think, either one, don't do it, or how can you mitigate that? So if it's done and that problem develops, can you mitigate it? So that's the deep water. Certainly surface water, you pointed out that these holding tanks, holding the water, overruns, and you can then sort of contaminate on the surface water. But again, and I guess the way the system is supposed to work, the question becomes what kind of mitigating measures can one take to solve that problem? We had ash pits up at our, at our plant in Peekskill. I mean, there are these pits all over the country. They're nasty places. They do nasty things. But presumably, pursuant to regulations, I guess, you can build them and have containments and secondary containment, whatever, to mitigate it. So where does that fit into the system?
Two things. One, to respond to your first question, when we first looked at this, when we came out with our stance that this was inappropriate within the watershed, we came to that answer thinking about, regardless of what happens deep underground, regardless of the fracking that happens thousands of feet below ground, we know enough that The surface impacts alone make this inappropriate within the watershed.
I see. Like, okay. Well, but I guess if we don't even, I certainly agree they shouldn't be anywhere near the watershed. So if you start with not anywhere near the watershed, and then you're still going down. I mean, mm-hmm. one might argue, as long as we're going down 5,000 feet, we can go one to the watershed, too. I don't support that. We should be away to begin with, but then even far away, they're going down so deep, mm-hmm. they're down below the groundwater. So again, one, it seems reasonable to assume, even if there are problems way down there, I mean, Howard, putting as a viable project, putting high-level nuclear waste down in the salt domes, and you know, you put it down there, and you wait 10,000 years and see what happens. But the surface water, I mean, again, but through regulation or through permits, the DEC answer, I guess, we're going to solve this through permits.
Well, to answer your second question, the draft environmental review that we saw didn't provide those answers. From our perspective, it failed miserably in terms of trying to establish the adequate mitigation measures to forestall that type of contamination that you're talking about.
Are there financial penalties associated with the permits in violation of a permit? I guess their existing regimen, because I can foresee, you know, this is business. This is at the end of the day. I would think, maybe, I don't know, regulatory wise, you can put maybe more severe penalties or fines that are then to be placed in the permit. Drawing these permits, what are these permits based on? Are they putting fines in the permits?
Well, it's funny. I mean, obviously, state and federal law do have fines. One of the things about hydraulic fracturing is, first of all, while the EPA is very concerned about this, and while the EPA the past couple weeks has announced that they're going to get the money to start a study that investigates possible problems with hydraulic fracturing, they have very little regulatory authority here. It is really left to the states, and we can go into that. It's kind of a separate issue, and there's legislation that's hoping they'll hopefully change that. But it is really on the states here. And for instance, I know this article that was passed out today is an article in the continuing New York Times Toxic Water series. Well, one of the earlier articles in that series talked about the lack of enforcement nationwide, particularly in New York State, where there are, I think we counted about 800 violations in the watershed where no fine was ever assessed. And so what we have is an issue, and I'm talking broadly here, but in general, if you look at the states and you look at their enforcement records, and even here in New York, you'll find that they are very lax. And you know, the industry, I mean, I was just on a panel, I was at a panel last week, and someone from Chesapeake Energy said, well, we want enforcement. You know, we want the highest possible environmental bar. Well, if that's true, that's great. But unfortunately, generally, I don't know if they're going to get there unless it's mandated. And right now,
Mr. Chairman, here's how it seems to me that that on the one hand, there's an energy resource that, you know, one way or another is going to get developed, and frankly, it probably, you know, to some extent, should be developed. But my concern is, I imagine there should be a regulatory scheme, probably, because one way to address this, and it's done in other industries, in the dry cleaning industry, if by regulation, I assume you set up a fund. I mean, what the EIS should be saying, and I don't know, certain things can they be cleaned up? I mean, one thing, if you destroy something, that's why you gotta stay within the watershed, you know, because I'm not sure how well you clean up Rye Lake. But if the industry were required to set up a fund, so that person who has the local well and they got gas and their drinking water, you take money out of the fund, in addition to suing the company, but take money out of this fund to mitigate it. Connecticut has a great fund for dry cleaners. Contaminate the ground. Right.
Well, hopefully the goal would be to not contaminate the well.
Well, I know, but at the end of the day, the best, you know, there's just no zero technology. These wells, eventually, we have these pipes crack after 7 years. You put these wells down, and for the first 20 years, they're great, but sooner or later, either you don't do it at all, but sooner or later, something just may happen. But if there's just one example, a fund in place financed by the industry, because they're going to be making so much money, and in fact, some of these damages can be mitigated. I mean, if with dollars, one can fix, and sometimes you can't. I mean, I don't know. I mean, can you clean out? So usually you can with some kind of technology, you can clean out the groundwater and bring it back. All I'm saying, you probably can't do that through the permit program. I assume that kind of requirement, requiring industry-funded insurance fund, for example, just one idea, would take either a state law or at least a state regulation.
Right.
It's not authorized by law to do that.
One of the issues is, you know, throughout the EIS, the general tone is that we already have these regulations in place. You know, that we've been having gas drilling. The first gas well in the country was in Fredonia, New York, in 1821, and obviously no one's arguing that. But I think that what DEC is saying is it's sort of the attitude that pervades the document is sort of this trust us attitude. Mm-hmm. Look, this is our job. We're going to do it. You know, we've always had these regulations in place, and we're going to continue to enforce them. But you know that's based on an assumption that we don't agree with, which
the new technology,
which is that these regulations are adequate and that they're being enforced. Mm-hmm. Neither of which are true. So you know that in our minds. So that's I think one of the we felt like they didn't really take the hard look that they had at least led us to believe they were going to take. Now they received over 14,000 comments. Around thereabouts, 14,000 comments to this environmental impact statement, which I have to imagine is probably one of the largest amount of comments they've received on an environmental impact statement. And you know, if you ask EEC right now, what are they doing? They're reviewing the comments. Oh. And
I mean, the amount of water, I imagine the other kind of gas drilling, the amount of water that seems to be used with this particular type of drilling. Now, that 3 million gallons, is that what it takes? That's the total, it's not like daily, is that what it takes to fracture the shale and you're done, or is it? That's the total.
Per fracture.
And so
again, each well requires several fractures. Okay. Each pad has several wells on it.
I know there's issues about flow, stream flows. I mean, I think you're on the right track. So it seems that.
And where's that water coming from?
Regulations.
What streams and rivers in New York?
So that's your cumulative impact.
That water coming from?
How much water
is getting there? You're building a road. You're getting to this water. You're building a road. You're sending trucks, whizzing down these winding mountain roads with this water, and that's just to start the process. And then, of course, really one of the big issues is what comes back up, because what comes back up, first of all, does not always look like what goes back down because of this radioactivity. And the New York State Department of Health sent a memo to DEC, I believe it was last summer, and we have that in our comments. That said, that they had gone out and done testing, and they had found, levels of radioactivity in flowback water, in wastewater, that were hundreds of times, allowable levels.
Can you mitigate that? How do you mitigate that? That's
another issue, an even simpler issue, that's just as dangerous as in Wyoming. It's not exactly this technology, but what they found is that when they injected the high-pressure water and the chemicals down, what they got was high-concentrated salt water that came up, and it killed all of the streams, all of the water bodies, and the ranching community that's out there, that's not, you'd not consider to be a natural partner of the environmental community, were so incensed that it killed all their grazing land because their water supply was destroyed by the high levels of salt in it. So, everything that you inject down is going to force things back up.
Right, and that's, again, another good point. First is the whole issue of what chemicals are they using. Right. Well, we know what chemicals they might be using, but we don't know the actual, chemical constituency. We don't know the proprietary blend that they use in this frac fluid. They guard it just like Coca-Cola guards its secret formula. And so here you have a regulatory agency, how can they possibly say they've taken a hard look at the environmental issues when they don't even know what chemicals they're looking at? And not only that, they list all the wastewater treatment plants in New York as if even one of them is equipped to handle wastewater like this. And they're not at all. And how would you even know what kind of waste you're taking in if you don't have to know what the chemicals are? So it's just, again, just so many questions and not enough answers, and it's just
Mr. Chair, we're being asked, I guess, to look at a resolution and maybe take a position on this, and it seems to me a Riverkeeper has laid out a whole bunch of impacts. One could argue, as serious as they are, certainly the site specific, the roads and at least the local traffic are serious impacts. I'm wondering, is that taking it up on the site-specific permit? As opposed to these do some site-specific secret seeker documentation on how disruptive. My point is, in any kind of action we take, I see local impacts that still need to be reviewed somewhere in the system. But if we're looking to jump into this, which we should, on the more generic, from the chemicals, from the broader cumulative use of water, the broader impacts, and you know how this all is
on
playing
Westchester's out. Westchester's water drinking supply.
And on our drinking supply, and I'm concerned, because honestly, it seems financial penalties have to be in there somewhere to, if nothing else, gets the industry at least to try to comply, because complying with regulations or directives, we've heard here in many other situations, cheaper to pay the penalty. Mm-hmm. Comply. Certainly when you're talking about these kinds of impacts, we can't afford that.
Marty, if I may,
so in terms of drafting a resolution,
right, just organizationally, since I think that would be further down the road, just for the sake of this meeting, let me just open it up, see if other people have comments. Let's get that input, and then while your conversation's right on the money, I think that's the next one down the road. So do we have any, first of all, questions for the Riverkeeper folks, specific questions for them, and then we'll take general comments or other groups that would like to put comments on the record. Yes, ma'am.
Marley Morgan from FCWC. As I understand it, water is becoming shorter in this country as well as around the world. And the water that is used in this process cannot be made back into drinking water, as I understand it. Is that what you understand? That once it's gone, so we're already facing a shortage of water for which there is no substitute. Energy has substitutes, so I think the thing really has to be based on a matter of the irreplaceable matter of water. In any part of the country.
I think that's true. This is a classic consumptive use of water.
Exactly.
Water that's not really being used.
So if we can get along without natural gas, we can't get along without.
All right, right now, if we can, let's just focus on questions, and then certainly we'll take statements or comments from anybody and everybody. Any other questions for the Riverkeeper folks? All right, so then we'll open it up for statements and comments. And
Hi.
Please stand so the sure. reporter can hear you and state your name and organization for the
okay,
record.
Okay, my name is Susan Leifer, and I've been working with the State Sierra Club on water issues and on fracking. And for one thing, I just want to mention, because we talk about economic things, we have right now stored in the United States 15% more natural gas than we've had ever in the last 5 years, and that includes winter. So we're not desperate for natural gas. And all that money and infrastructure that we could put into wind energy. And if you talk about economic issues such as jobs, if you were to insulate and retrofit every single building in New York State, you would get 18 times more jobs than you would in this kind of work, because this is a gypsy group that comes here and then they move someplace else and they move someplace else. These are not permanent jobs. Towns in the West that have allowed gas have gone through a boom and bust cycle and have not had a very good economic record. And then we're just talking about trashing. I mean, anytime you open up a forest for a road, widen it, you are going to get invasive species. Your forests are basically what cleanses your wetlands, and your forests are what keeps your water clean. Without forests, you will not have clean water. So as you damage these forests, you are also diminishing not only the amount of water that you're sucking up to do for this fracking, but you're diminishing the cleanliness of your water in total. And I agree with her that we can't afford it. And my understanding is that for each fracking, you use more and more water. So any particular well can be fracked from 5 to 15 times. So if the first time you use 3 million gallons of water, the second time you only use 5, 10, you keep going up the scale. So these things can have been in other states from 5 to 12 times. We talk about a county that I think you've read about in Texas called Dish, Texas. And Dish, Texas has been drilled to death. And what they are suffering from is increased rates of childhood leukemia. Somebody did a study for them that they have produced as much smog in this little town outside of Fort Worth, Texas, as all of Fort Worth, Texas is producing with their car traffic. So we're talking about air pollution. The gas company says that 10% methane is released just automatically. Now, your methane, if you're talking about this being a cleaner technology than oil and coal, methane for the first 20 years is about 100 times more potent a climate change than carbon. So you're talking about right now sending up tons of this stuff. And this is to take away the infrastructure from wind energy, for example, or solar energy. It seems a very poor way to put our money. And then the further thing is I read, which I thought was very interesting, the oil companies have now gotten interested in gas companies. So ExxonMobil made a overture to buy half of Exto gas. There's one little thing on it. If the Fracking Act passes in Congress, they're out of it. So they're getting a free ride, and the communities, toll communities, are paying for it. And I think if you impoverish upstate, it will not benefit all of us. You can't, in other words, hurt one area and not hurt another area. It doesn't make any sense. We don't have control right now of anything but New York State, but people are looking to New York State all around the country because we're the first state that said, wait a second, let's take a look at it. And you're looking at the DEC employees who are saying to us, this can't be done. We don't have enough inspectors. We don't have enough information. We don't have enough control. Pennsylvania left its reporting to the gas companies. And it wasn't until this 42-mile strip was decimated of stream that they reported it. There's four acts coming up in the Assembly in New York State. They're very small acts. Sweeney is doing them in the Assembly. One says that you can't leave this water on the pad more than 1 week. That means you have to have a place to send it to, and you have no place to send it to right now that can clean it. And in fact, it's not even clear that you can actually clean it, because there are certain of the substances that they've used in fracking that parts per billion can cause genetic damage, can cause carcinogenics, can cause endocrine disruptors. So the point is that if you don't have a place to even reasonably clean it, you have no place to absolutely clean it in any place in New York State, and who's going to bear the cost of that? So, okay, those are the final.
No, I wasn't cutting you off.
And I'll let other people talk, but it seems to me that if we put our money and our minds into it, a sustainable energy structure, we would do ourselves a big favor. It seems to me that if we retrofit and insulate all our buildings, we would create as many jobs as we need, and those are not jobs that can be sent off to India. And it seems to me that there are a lot of different solutions. This is because of the subsidies, government subsidies to oil and gas, state subsidies to the Empire State, development subsidies, the IDAs from all the counties. The taxpayers are basically paying for the drilling. The gas people are taking the money and running with it because they're getting the money from selling the gas, but they're not paying for the drilling. We're paying for the drilling, and then we're going to pay for cleaning it up afterwards. And one of the other things that Sweeney has brought up is that they have a $5,000 fine for... you can't rebuild your well for $5,000. I mean, if your house blows up because of the methane, $5,000... You can't get insurance for 300 feet from a well, so that means that your mortgage is gone. You can't get a mortgage and you can't keep your mortgage because you have no house insurance. I think it has to be looked at long and hard, and I think we're all on the right track by saying, slow down, look at this. This is not a very easy economic addition.
And there's certainly great economic wisdom to what you say about the energy retrofits and the economic impact that will have.
You also have farming, you have wine, all of these industries, tourism, are all going to be changed because of industrial wells. I mean, nobody's going to go touristing up to see industrial wells.
Do we have any other comments? Yes, sir.
John Messina, just a citizen. If it's not good to drill in the watershed area, then it's not good to drill in the rest of the state. And I think you should look at it as a whole state, not just the watershed area. There are other reservoirs in the area that serve various communities, and they would be affected just as well as New York City. Number two, there is drilling going on right now in New York State with hydrofracking. You should make note of that.
Where would that be?
I am privy to one well, and if you want that location, I'll give it to you.
It'd be interesting to know, yeah.
Route 7, on the west side of Route 7, in the town of Maryland, New York.
Near Oneonta.
Just outside of Oneonta.
When you're talking, I mean, it's not high-volume hydraulic fracturing though, and horizontal drilling, right? Are you talking about vertical drilling? I know there's some vertical.
No, it's going to be, it's hydrofracking.
Ma'am, you had your hand up.
Yeah, I'm Jill Garrison from the Legal Women Voters in Newcastle. My question really, it's not from them, it's very personal. I read some articles coming from, generated from upstate newspapers, specifically in Binghamton, and there were letters to the editor in the newspaper there by individuals who'd already sold their rights and contracted with the gas companies to drill on their land, and they said, you know, it's my land, I can do what I want. So what's the status of that, and how does this fold in with any kind of approvals that might be forthcoming?
Yeah, well, it's, you know, this is what makes this issue so, I think, complicated and politically charged, is that you do have the issue of private landowners who do have a right to do, you know, certain things with their land, and
even to the detriment of the community.
Right. Well, you know, right. I mean, that's why, again, you know, it's very complicated. I mean, there are, you know, first of all, now if you're upstate, you're getting offered $6,000 per acre, plus upwards of 20% royalties on the gas, and that is absolutely. And we recognize. I mean, this is not, you know, I'm not going to go upstate and tell people, you know, you can't do this on your land, you can't do that. I mean, this is a real economic situation here. I know people down in Pennsylvania that have a $100,000 check on their kitchen table, and the company calls them every day. You cash it yet? You cash it yet? All they have to do is sign it, and that's it. And you know what? They may never even come on your land. They may not even find gas there. And also in New York, it's particularly troubling because if you're neighboring landowners, I think it's, what, 60% of your adjacent landowners have leases, well, then you're basically by compulsory integration. You have to be involved. Now you can choose to get in on it, or you can choose not to. But either way, you're going to be impacted. So, you know, like, I mean, I think it's a great point. And you know, again, our understanding is that no permits for horizontal drilling and high volume hydraulic fracturing will be issued until this environmental review process is complete. Chesapeake Energy, I know just Chesapeake has 50 permits pending, and they're just, you know, as soon as this final environmental impact statement comes out, those permits, I mean, you know, they are going to be, you know, getting them through as fast as possible. And once the permits go in, that's when they can start going into the land that they've already got the mineral rights to. So I'm not sure if that answers the question, but it's difficult.
It's an issue.
It's absolutely an issue. And some of the landowner groups, to their credit, have been working together to try to collectively get the best contracts that they can. And certainly we encourage that. I mean, all landowners, they should certainly have attorneys looking at these contracts. And they, you know, they need to ensure that there's testing of their individual drinking water wells before anything happens. Because a lot of times...
They'll say, that wasn't me. I didn't do that.
A lot of times there is no testing. So people find benzene in their drinking water and they say, well, you can't prove it was us. And the truth is you can't prove it was them because there was never any testing done before. However, it probably, you know, might have been something that would have come to light beforehand if it was that bad. But.
Okay, we've got Susan, then we've got Marty, and then Matt.
Okay, there's a fourth bill, and that is that to have an individual EIS for each well pad. What we're seeing now is a generic for the state. If it goes through everybody's under the same umbrella. Now, each well pad has different environmental problems and things that could go wrong. And so it doesn't make sense to make a law. And I'm sure that's one of the things that everybody said in their comments. It doesn't make sense to set a law for everybody. I will reiterate what she said. There's no substitute for water. We can't replace water. We can try and heat ourselves a lot of different ways, but we cannot replace our water. And if we squander it, we squander it. About 1% of all the world's water is drinkable. And that's just a finite amount that doesn't get bigger. So we squander pieces of it. We're in big trouble.
Okay. Legislator Rogowski, then we'll get over to Matt.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I just wanted to say I think River to Keep is doing a great job. I hope you've got the resources if they finalize this and they're not planning on doing regulations that you sue them. That's what usually takes sometimes. But you know, the flip side of this, I think it's Schuyler or Livingston. We got a resolution in one county that is complaining that state law only allows the county to enter a 5-year lease. And they want to enter into longer-term leases with the gas company. So they're asking us, on the other side, to support state legislation,
right,
changing county laws to allow longer leasing. So it depends where you sit as to what your interests are. So there are counties, I guess, want to lease their public lands for this.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's going to be very complicated.
So there's at least two sides. But I think it's very important to. I know some of my towns are reviewing the same issues. Harrison debated this the other night. We need to be concerned about our drinking water because we're at the tail end of this. And I don't know why they can't do the regulations to cover the specifics. So good luck on there, but hopefully we'll do what we can.
Thanks, appreciate that.
All right, Matt Wallach, Citizens Campaign for the Environment. We're also one of the many groups, obviously, as opposed to this. And I'm not going to echo everyone's comments. We agree with everyone's here, and we always obviously supporting a moratorium on any type of hydrofracking until we have some real answers. And obviously, we brought up the question issues and so many questions because of the newness of this technology. And we have the advantage of seeing what other states are doing. We have the advantage of the EPA study, and that could be a minimum of a moratorium of at least looking at the EPA study of effects of high volume hydrofracking on water quality before any type of drilling is created. We also work closely with some counties upstate New York that has passed resolutions against high volume hydrofracking. Tompkins County is on Onondaga County as well. And we have also prepared a white paper, I think a 20-page white paper about the issue as well.
Do we have that?
I could get that to you.
Yeah, please, as well as the resolutions. Mm-hmm.
And one of the most telling issues, as well as about all the money that gas companies have given out to these leases, so many instances where there's land for sale and the gas companies refuse to purchase that land for drilling because they don't want the liability of owning that land, knowing that there is a good chance that the cost of cleanup for the landowner is so much more than it would take just to lease that land. So the leases cost more than the purchasing of the land, but they won't purchase that land. They'll spend a lot more in leasing because they know that they'll have the long-term benefits of that. And also, just for one other thing is, we feel that this is tied greatly to the New York State budget and the amount of tax dollars that's going towards Marcellus shale drilling compared to other things is very inappropriate, considering the state of the budget as well as the DEC. And experts have called for an adequate staff at the DEC that could actually enforce this to be access over 300 people. So just on Marcellus shale enforcement. And obviously that's not the case. So for it to even be an act, just for enforcing, for any type of enforcement issue, New York State's not even close, not even a fraction close to having any type of ability to even enforce this. If this does go through at any time in the foreseeable future, it will be self-enforcement or no enforcement.
You raise an interesting point, and Susan did as well, about the economic investment of taxpayer dollars And my question is, has anybody quantified what the public investment in this will be?
It's unknowable. I mean, the amount of money to I apologize, I got here a little late, but I think I came in when you were talking about roads. Just to who pays for roads? You know, just that alone is immense. The sewage treatment facilities. And it's, a lot of it's unforeseeable because we don't know what we have to clean up, whether it's in a well, whether it's in a sewage treatment facility, whether it's in a water body. We don't yet know what and sometimes how to clean up all this stuff.
Okay, Chris, before we wrap up, do you have any questions from your perspective?
I have a quick question, thanks. Do we know if the transmission infrastructure is adequate to receive the proposed gas that would be produced?
We don't. And that's a big problem because CEQA, the law under which this environmental review is being conducted, exempts any analysis of transmission lines or impacts from transmission lines or a study to answer just that one question. Is there enough infrastructure in place to distribute the gas once it's released? We don't know. But I think, you know, just to sum up briefly, and we urge the legislature to either enact a resolution or draft some sort of a letter to the state about this issue. We've heard here several, many different impacts, and like we've said, we'll be sure to get Chris our full comments, which are extensive. But it's our experience that the state rushed through this environmental review, and it's our understanding they were told to rush through it. They were pushed to rush through it. There was political pressure applied on the agency to get this out the door. The state saw the dollars that are involved here. There's no question this would be a huge shot in the arm to the New York State economy. You know, it's no secret we're in bad straits. So it's our perspective that the state saw those dollar signs and sort of ignored everything else and just wants to reach for that golden apple. And we're just asking the state, slow down, where's the fire, enact adequate mitigation techniques so all these impacts don't occur.
And it's just that we'll hopefully in the near future.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think if I can just sum up for the committee, if you can get us your full comments plus any quantifiable information on impacts in other jurisdictions, if anybody else has detailed information or comments, please get them to Chris. I would tend to agree with Legislator Rogowski that some sort of resolution coming out of this committee to our colleagues on the full board would be in order. We'll get to work on that. I can't say I speak for the full committee because they're not all here, but certainly I would agree with that assessment and would work on that and try and move that forward. So we thank you all for coming. It's been a good first conversation, part of the conversation, and we'll keep advancing this issue with forth.
Mr. Chair, I'll move the minutes of February 22nd and March 1st, 2010.
Okay, do we have a second?
Second.
All in favor? Aye.
Aye.
We have a motion to close?
So moved.
All righty, thanks. Thanks, everyone. Thank you.
Thanks, Chris.